The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. It is Tuesday, February the 25th, 2025. It is 10:10 a.m. here in the UK. It is 10 minutes past midday over in South Africa, where my good friend Dr. Peter Hammond is. So let's bring him up right away. Peter, are you with us?
I am with you, yes. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And another timely presentation for you today, ladies and gentlemen. The real story of the Ukraine war and why it must end. So, Peter, where would you like to start us off with today's topic?
Yes, well, here we are at about the 30th anniversary of the war in Ukraine. And it is probably worthwhile to just stop for a moment and recognize what does this cost? And there's been a tremendous amount of cost. Now, I mean, some of the cost factors are hard to agree on, because obviously the first casualty in war is truth. And we are dealing with a really deceptive operation in many ways, and we're going to get to that too. But according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Estimates, ACLED, there have been at least 153,000 casualties so far since the war began, 24th of February, 2022. And so here we are just one day after the third anniversary. The Human Rights Office, the United Nations Human Rights Office, put civilian deaths in this conflict at around 12,654. And they claim 669 children have also died in this conflict. So the UN says there's been more than 29,000 civilians injured. And interestingly, they also claim, according to Kiev, who've been winning all the time, according to the news media, and Russia have been losing all the time. But right now it's like it's all over, and Kiev has no chance, and they've basically lost the war. So interesting how all those news reports turned out to have been fake. There were so many victories that were fraudulent. There's so many, like, remember the ghost of Kiev, some fictional pilot who's meant to be shooting down MiGs all over the place. Well, it turns out in the end that the Russians didn't lose any of their aircraft really over Kiev, and those were just sucked out the thumb to build up morale. But there's been a lot of propaganda, fake victories that have been produced over the years in many different wars, and now it turns out we've been lied to. And according to Kiev, though, they have lost 45,000 soldiers killed in action, 380,000 wounded, and tens of thousands more missing in action. Some of whom, I think, deserted entire divisions, deserted, leaving their weapons and tents and so on all behind. And, you know, this has been documented quite well on RT. The refugee crisis is most catastrophic. There are 6.9 million Ukrainian refugees globally. And there's millions of Ukrainians far from their home. There's another 4 million Ukrainians who are believed to be internally displaced. In other words, they've lost their homes. They haven't fled out the country, but they're not in the country. So the majority of Ukrainians are now living across Europe, most living in Germany, which has 1.2 million Ukrainian refugees. Poland has another million. The Czech Republic has 390,000. The United Kingdom apparently has 250,000 Ukrainian refugees living in the country as of December. And that is pretty bad. Now, about the financial burden, According to a press conference, President Zelensky said the war has cost Ukraine over $320 billion, or £253 billion, the majority of which, he says, was shouldered by his country, which makes you wonder what happened to all the money sent in by America, because America claims to have sent over $300 billion to Ukraine in aid and weapons and so on, although Zelensky says he can't account for $100 billion of it. So interesting now that America's demanding some repayment, as Zelensky's claiming that they got a lot less aid than they actually did, which makes you wonder what happened to those missing $100 billion and so on. That's, you know, a lot of money. Well, interesting how Ukraine's gross domestic product has plummeted. It's estimated only around 78% of its pre-war level, so they've lost a lot of their worth and value. Interestingly, during this war, Russia's gross domestic product has grown every year, and it's up by 4% just from last year, and every year it's grown by at least 3%, which is estimated by $2 trillion by the World Bank. So Russia has benefited by the increased oil and gas prices, which is particularly because Biden administration chopped and crushed American self-sufficiency in oil and gas and had to import more. So that meant more income for Russia to pay for more weapons, because the price of oil and gas, which is their main export, only went up. So interestingly, Russia's GDP has grown, even as Ukraine's been demolished. Interestingly, Russia spent $140 billion on defense just in the last year, which is less than half the amount of money that the US has poured into Ukraine in finances, not to mention the EU and NATO. So that's according to the Center for European Policy Analysis. Interesting, defense spending now eats up 40% of the Russian government's expenditure, but only 8% of their GDP. Now, they've been involved in a major war, but the war has only cost them less than 8% of their gross domestic product. And interestingly, America's taken over 110,000 square kilometers of territory in Ukraine, mostly areas where Russians are the majority ethnically and population-wise. So we've got, just in 2024, Russia conquered another 4,200 square kilometers of territory. And the war has included a huge amount of battles. There's, according to ACLED, 146 cases of violence, meaning everything from battles to skirmishes, a drone attack or a bombing, 146,000 instances of violence since the start of this war back in February of 2022. Now, they say that there have been over 25,000 drone strikes, 80,000 instances of artillery or shelling and missile strikes, and 36,000 battle events where troops have clashed on the ground. So it's been mostly an air and artillery war so far. Ukraine claims to have 880,000 soldiers still in uniform now, and Russia claims to have 1.5 million people mobilized in the army. And Zelensky claimed, I don't know how he knows this, that 600,000 Russian troops are in Ukraine, or what used to be Ukraine, at least in 2022. They also claim that 10,000 North Korean troops have been sent in to the war to come and help Russia, which is intriguing. Recruiting has cost Russia around $16 billion to recruit the soldiers they've got right now, according to the Carnegie Institute. Ukraine has turned now from, first of all, conscripting everyone from 25 to 60 to conscripting 18 to 25-year-olds as well. And Ukraine has offered prisoners the chance to be released if they will join the military, and that recruits another 27,000 prisoners as soldiers. One wonders how well soldiers do if they come from a criminal background. The cost of sanctions is another concern. Britain apparently has frozen £22 billion of Russian assets. That's billion. £22 billion of Russian assets are frozen in the UK. And one wonders what's going to happen to all that. there are at least 42 countries in the world that have allocated aid for Ukraine, and it's estimated Ukraine has received over 267 billion euros in aid. And most of that's probably been lost into corruption, as Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries in Europe, if not in the world. And military aid from Europe has been about 62 billion euros, and military aid from the United States has been over 64 billion euros, just between February 2022 and December 2024. So that's not total. And we also know that UK has given over 12 billion pounds of aid to Ukraine, and that's as of January of this year. Mr. Trump claims America has given over $350 billion in aid to Ukraine, which Zelensky claims is more than they've actually received, but he can't account for most of it anyway. So that's intriguing, just taking the loss of life. Now, the amount of soldiers killed, nobody wants to admit how many of their men have died, and especially when, generally speaking, press reports are about how we're winning, 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 but send us lots more money and weapons. And we can see now we've been lied to on many, many, many levels on this. And it's incredible. At the Munich Security Conference, the chairman literally wept publicly and was applauded for some reason after the vice president of America gave a speech that Europe must stop fearing its own citizens and its own voters and allowed freedom of speech again. And basically told Europe, get your act together, prepare to defend yourself. You can't keep counting on America. We've got our own problems, and we're focusing on our own borders and the threat of China in the East. So Europe must stop depending on American support. And that was a real wake-up call for many of the people. And Vice President Vance's speech was considered to be a real turning point in world history. And the fact that American government now is no longer strongly committed to wanting to continue the war in Ukraine. I had a letter from a friend in Ukraine. I've got several friends who are missionaries to Ukraine. And interestingly enough, one of the missionaries to Ukraine is the granddaughter of our president, P.W. Botha. And her mother's a good friend of our family, and her father's a good friend of mine. And in fact, she attended one of our great commission courses and ended up going to Ukraine as a missionary. And when the war began, we said, aren't you coming back? And she said, no, how can I? They need me now more than ever. So there are a number of South African missionaries in Ukraine. There's some other American missionaries and so on too. And what we hear from them is, when the money stops flowing, the war will stop. When people stop making money out of this war, the war will stop. And I think that that's a good observation. So with President Trump threatening to cut the purse strings and the funding of this war, the war is bound to come to an end right now, because it's only been fueled by Western funding all the way along. And the Biden administration created this crisis, remember, in order to have a scapegoat for the great collapse, which the New World Order was very much committed to. Remember, the globalists were planning to stage a great collapse as a prerequisite for the Great Reset, and even Slime magazine was promoting that. And with remember, just before the war began in February of 2022, there was rising resistance to the dragged-out pandemic panic, and the propaganda was no longer having its impact. And so the military conflict in Ukraine was presented as unprovoked Russian aggression. Well, it was Russian aggression, but to call it unprovoked is totally untrue, because it certainly was provoked. The Biden administration was doing everything they could in order to propel and fast-track Ukraine into NATO and to get U.S. assets into Ukraine, including American biological warfare laboratories. And there was all kinds of bizarre things going on, and talk about Ukraine becoming part of NATO. Now, bearing in mind what happened back in 1993, when Russia tried to put military bases in Cuba, that almost precipitated a nuclear world war, as the Americans said, you can't place your military bases and missiles in our backyard, Monroe Doctrine and all that. And it's well been pointed out that what America's tried to do in Ukraine is the modern equivalent of what Russia did back in 1960s and trying to put a missile base or missile bases in Cuba. And Ukraine is in Russia's backyard and it's part of their strategic sphere of influence. And so Ukraine was used and abused by Biden's State Department for nefarious New World Order objectives. And I think it needs to be reminded that there was a coup d'etat in 2014 under the administration of Barack Hussein Obama when Biden was the vice president. They put $5 billion, USAID put $5 billion in, and the State Department, USAID, basically bankrolled and supplied. Victoria Nuland actually boasted this. They set up whole media empires, radio, TV stations, newspapers, magazines. They sponsored a whole movement which led to the Mayan Revolution or the Color Revolution, which toppled the elected government of Ukraine back in 2014. And when that government came to power after ousting the democratically elected government in Ukraine, one of the first things they did was they legalized all the homosexual grooming, the LGBTQ things, so that the Russians saw this as basically a gay agenda war, an LGBTQ war, to create perversion in Ukraine that was legal because the previous government had laws against it. And then they also banned Russian as a minority language, even in areas where Russian was the language of 90% of the people, in the Donbass and Luhansk regions in the eastern Ukraine. And so, interestingly, the war really started in 2014 as the Ukrainian army and air force began shelling, rocketing, strafing, and bombing civilians, killing over 14,000 civilians in eastern Ukraine, where Russians are 95 to 98% of population. And as a result, secessionist movements arose, and you saw Luhansk and Donetsk secede from Ukraine and seek security arrangements with Russia. And of course, they were ethnically and they were linguistically Russian. And one needs to remember that eastern Ukraine was actually, for many, many, many years, separate from Ukraine. In fact, the history is quite intriguing because you can see that Ukraine's territory was quite small in 1654. But the Russian Tsars added a lot of the north, which includes Kiev territory, to Ukraine over the years. And then Joseph Stalin added a whole lot in the west to Ukraine back in 1939, 1945. Through their annexations, and the area in the far east, which is the Donetsk regions now in Luhansk, they were added to Ukraine by Vladimir Lenin. And then Nikita Khrushchev added Crimea to Ukraine arbitrarily in 1954 without referendum or anything, even though over 90% of the population of Crimea are Russian. And they voted by a huge margin in referendum to be independent from Ukraine when Ukraine was toppled by this American-backed coup in 2014. So that's the context. For people to say it began with unprovoked Russian aggression in 2022, ignoring the context of the tremendous provocations. Also, just an immediate context, in 2022, January, President Vladimir Putin requested a meeting with Joe Biden, and Joe Biden refused. He requested confirmation assurance that America would not put any missiles or military bases in Ukraine. Ignored. Even in February 2022, President Putin of Russia requested urgent meeting with Biden. Biden ignored it. So there were all kinds of opportunities to end the war earlier. And even in the first week of the invasion, there was an offer given by Russia that we can have a ceasefire and the war can be over if there will be guarantees given that Ukraine doesn't join NATO and that you will recognize the autonomy and language rights of their Russian majority citizens in the east of Russia and the Donbass regions east of Ukraine. And so when these were bypassed, and there was even an agreement settled in the capital of Turkey, sponsored by Turkey, which Ukraine was happy to agree to and sign, but Boris Johnson and Biden butted in and bullied Ukraine into not signing the ceasefire and peace treaty, but to continue with the war. So again, it's just tragic. You think hundreds of thousands of people have died and millions have lost their homes in a war that was avoidable, preventable, and could have ended a lot earlier. So this is long past due that the war actually comes to an end. This is outrageous, and it's long overdue that this comes to an end. The other things to bear in mind is Crimea is the equivalent to Russia of Hawaii and the naval headquarters of the American Pacific Fleet, San Diego. So you've got in Crimea the only ice-free winter port that Russia possesses, and it's an important port for their navy, and Crimea's been Russian since they liberated it from the Turks in the days of Catherine the Great in the 1700s. And so Russia has owned Crimea longer than the United States has owned Hawaii, and it's even more strategically important for them. So it's a bit insane to think that they can be talking about Crimea must be returned to Russia. Well, Crimea never was Russian, was never Ukrainian, I should say, and that Russia should return Crimea to Ukraine doesn't make any sense. That would just guarantee the war continuing and more people dying, especially as it's not the will of the population living in Crimea. They are Russian and they want to remain part of Russia, not Ukraine. So the population in Crimea, ethnically, linguistically, and culturally Russian. And Russia's got a lot of troops in Crimea and many establishments of bases, which they can't easily move, especially the naval bases. So they're not going to give up Crimea. I mean, that's just a fact. And that's not realistic to think that they could do so. Now, when you look at this, it's Barack Hussein Obama came to hate Putin for opposing his LGBTQ agenda. And when Russia banned gay propaganda to children in 2013, Obama gave the go-ahead for his State Department and USAID to stage a coup, organize and finance a coup in Kiev, which toppled the elected government. And so there are books written out, like Michael Lucas produced the book Campaign of Hate Against and in Russia and Gay Propaganda, speaking about the gay aspect to the hostility for Russia. And Barack Obama set up a series of provocative, threatening events like a row of dominoes so as to be able to accuse Russia of aggression. And Biden, of course, was part of that. This Russian aggression in the media could then be used to restart the Cold War and justify American military intervention in Ukraine as a pretext for basically plundering it. And this initiated a campaign of mafia-styled piracy. There was a protection racket on a national scale. And there's books like Peter Schweitzer's book Profiles in Corruption, which includes Biden, of course, and Kamala Harris, and all the different usual suspects that we've got in the U.S. Democrat Party. Joe Biden was the godfather, and his son Hunter served as the in-country enforcer. And Hunter Biden earned $156 million from corruption in Ukraine. And basically, at 49 years old, Hunter Biden joined the board of Burisma Holdings, which is the Ukrainian natural gas company. And he joined the company in 2014, immediately after the coup. And then Joe Biden threatened the people of Ukraine when he was vice president that he would withhold $1 billion. You're not getting the $1 billion. I'm leaving here in 6 hours. If the prosecutor who was investigating Burisma's corruption is not fired, you're not getting the money. So he boasted on the 23rd of January in 2018, when he is still vice president, he boasted that he had withheld the $1 billion aid from Ukraine until they fired the prosecutor, as he said, you know. And you know what? son of a bitch, they've fired him, you know. So there's Biden actually boasting at a Council on Foreign Relations that he withheld foreign aid to Ukraine until it got rid of the prosecutors trying to investigate the corruption that his son was involved in at Burisma. And so there's been a real mainstream media buyout by the corrupt Biden and Obama administration, and which has been exposed, targeted those who disagreed with their war in Ukraine. This was so corrupt, and now USAID has been exposed as having been the slush fund that funded all of this. You just think of 2 Peter 2:19. While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. And that could be written over much of the US states and unfortunately Ukraine too. Because as a direct consequence of the Obama-sponsored Orange Revolution coup in 2014 and the immediate cancelling of the minority language rights of the Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, who in many places were the overwhelming majority, the east of Ukraine is like 95% Russian-speaking. And these regions had such an overwhelming Russian majority that regions like Donetsk and Luhansk declared independence from Ukraine and, of course, were recognized by Russia. And I've got people who I know in that area who were cheering when the Russians came and said, you know, at last, someone's speaking up for us, fighting for us, somebody cares. And they were welcoming the troops like liberators in eastern Ukraine. And then they were also recording that the civilian casualties in eastern Ukraine were caused by the Ukrainian army who were shelling, rocketing apartment blocks in civilian areas. So this is not a clear-cut good on one side, bad on the other Hollywood stereotype situation. The situation is quite complex, and make no mistake, there's been atrocities on both sides, but the Ukraine government has been particularly corrupt. And the poor people in Donbass suffered a lot. Estimates are at least 14,000 civilians died before the war even began officially in 2022 because of the Ukraine army's bombardment and attacks on the secessionist people, the Russian people of eastern Ukraine. So I think that's got to be regarded as one of the consequences, especially that in 2015 there was the Treaty of Minsk, the so-called Minsk Accords or Minsk Agreements, which recognized the boundaries of Donetsk and Luhansk in the Donbass regions of eastern Ukraine as being boundaries that need to be respected. When Biden rejected Russia's demands for a promise that Ukraine would not become a base for anti-Russian nuclear missiles, that refusal to give non-nuclear guarantees led to Vladimir Putin's predictable decision to formally recognize Donetsk and Luhansk as independent countries, and he entered into mutual defense agreements, which then, from the Russian perspective, justified their military incursion into these states and the offensive assault on Ukraine airports and Ukraine weapons and military infrastructure in 2022 because they were attacking his allies in the Donbass region of Luhansk and Donetsk. And geographically, Donetsk borders Russia's and has a stretch of the coastline on the Sea of Azov, which has strategic access to the Black Sea. And Luhansk is immediately north of Donetsk and also borders Russia. So these two states formed a friendly buffer zone for Russia between itself and the American-dominated client state of Ukraine. Now, I should say that in the 1980s, when the South African Army was fighting in Angola, we saw ourselves as fighting against Soviet proxies. The Soviet Union was using their proxies of communists in Angola and Cubans in Angola to wage their war. But all the weapons were Russian weapons, all Soviet weapons, and the MiGs, the T-62 tanks, all of them there, they were all from the Soviet Union. We saw what we were fighting was a proxy war against the Russians. And in the same way, I think the Russians can see what they're fighting in Ukraine as a proxy war against America, which is why only America and Russia sat down to the first peace talks, because they saw Ukraine as a client state and they're just surrogates. They don't need to be at the table for the initial discussion. This is primarily a conflict between Russia and America. And those people got outraged that Russia bombed Ukraine. And somebody brought out a documentary list on how many countries America's bombed, and that's democratic governments of America since the Second World War. The American bombing list includes Korea and China, 1950 to 1953, Guatemala in 1954, Indonesia in 1958, Cuba 1959 to 1961, Guatemala 1960, in the Congo 1964, Laos in 1964 to 1973, and America was never at war with Laos, not officially. Vietnam 1961 to 1973, Cambodia 1969 to 1970, Guatemala again from 1967 to 1969, Grenada 1983, Lebanon 1983, Lebanon 1984, Libya 1986, El Salvador 1980s, Nicaragua 1980s, Iran 1987, Panama, Iraq, Kuwait, Somalia 1993, Bosnia 1994, Bosnia 1995, Sudan 1998, Afghanistan 1998, Yugoslavia 1999, Yemen 2002, bombing of Iraq between 1991 to 2003, and that was done by both the US and the UK on a regular basis. Iraq 2003 to 2015, Afghanistan 2001 to 2015, bombing in Pakistan 2007 to 2015, Somalia 2007 to 2008 to 2011, Yemen 2009 to 2011, Libya 2011-2015, Syria from 2014-2015. So having bombed so many countries, it just seems a bit hypocritical for the Biden administration in America to have condemned Russia for bombing in Ukraine, which after all was bombing American Russian allies in the Donetsk region in the east of Ukraine. And when you think of the bombing of capital cities like in Serbia and the bombing in Yugoslavia, March, June 1999, over 1,700 civilians were killed by NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia in the capital city. And Serbia even launched legal cases against the 1999 bombings of NATO. And yet people were telling us at that time, but this is the first war, first bombing in Europe since the end of the Second World War, totally ignoring what had happened in Yugoslavia and Serbia. And then you think of NATO is only for Europe's protection. NATO is only a defensive alliance. Well, why were so many NATO countries involved in Afghanistan? Afghanistan's not even in Europe. And yet there were huge amounts, British, American, German, French, Canadian, Italian, Dutch, Polish, Australian, Spain, Denmark, Turkey, Norway, all had forces involved in Afghanistan. And how can that operation with 39 countries involved in it be called defensive for North Atlantic Treaty Organization alone? Then there was the massive bombing campaigns on Libya done by French, British forces under NATO, causing massive destabilization of Libya, which led to the human wave tsunami of migrants pouring into Europe, which millions of people from Libya, Syria, and other places destabilized fled into Europe, creating a demographic time bomb. So if NATO is a defensive alliance, why did they bomb Serbia, Afghanistan, and be involved in fact, just at the time of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the government of America, which was then under under Biden, they were bombing Libya, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan. So seven countries were being bombed by America while they were condemning Russia for bombing Ukraine, which America provoked. And think of the huge amounts of countries bombed by Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and George Bush and Obama. I mean, they were all responsible for bombing multiple countries. And yet they could be so hypocritical when it came to Russia trying to protect in their own backyard roughly what the Americans were complaining about in Cuba in 1960s when the situation was reversed. And U.S. military presence overseas is huge. I think America's got military in about 156 bases worldwide. That seems more like an empire than a republic. But with the world's attention riveted on the war in Ukraine, the American media began blaming America's internal economic troubles and failings because of democratic policies of Biden and Harris on the Ukraine-Russian conflict, with Biden even speaking about the Putin tax and a Putin increase in oil prices, whereas Putin had nothing to do with the increase in oil prices. It was Biden's domestic policy in banning local drilling and mining of oil off America's shores. He turned America from an oil self-sufficient country that had been established under his predecessor into one that had to export in petrol, which is what led to, directly to the increase in the petrol prices, not to mention the huge amounts of wastage and corruption in government, which has been exposed now by Doge. Because the first casualty in war is always truth. Proverbs 12:22 says, "Deliver my soul, O Lord, from lying lips and from a deceitful tongue. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal truthfully are his delight." And so politicians and journalists in America beat the war drums for the last 3 years, working up a patriotic fervor to rally behind the president, to punish Vladimir Putin, to support Ukraine, and to get America involved in the war, ever escalating. And anyone like Tucker Carlson advocating caution or trying to explain the complications and the context of the conflict were branded as unpatriotic traitors and as propagandists for Putin and so on. And the war had the potential to always spiral out of control and involve many more countries in Europe and even further afield, especially irresponsible reports on, you know, Russia had rocketed Poland and then discovered actually it was a mistake. Ukraine had accidentally shot a rocket which had landed in Poland. But never mind that. Let's go on to the next item. And over, you just saw they would continually, like at one point it was banned, ministers were locked up, churches were closed. The entire opposition in Ukraine was all something like 11 or 12 parties were banned. Only the president's party was allowed. So it became a one-party dictatorship, effectively. They couldn't hold elections because of the war. Zelensky had only been elected for 5 years, and that expired last year. But never mind that. You're fighting for democracy and freedom. Even though all independent journalists were banned and only state-controlled journalists were allowed, so media control, so religious freedoms infringed on, freedom of speech infringed on, freedom of religion infringed on, freedom of conscience, and the government itself is a one-party dictatorship, and yet the word everywhere around the world is that this is fighting for democracy. And you can imagine how many are getting sick of the propaganda, and why even President Trump has said, you know, he's getting sick of Zelensky. And it's well to remember that America under Obama and Biden refused the Russian president Vladimir Putin's proposals for Russian membership in NATO. Russia actually applied to join NATO back in 1999, 2007, turned down, and how different it would be if Russia was part of NATO. But instead, they were pushed into the hands of Red China because they had to have someone to trade with and for raw materials and so on. And so how difficult would it be to have a neutral and demilitarized Ukraine, non-nuclear, restore the minority language rights of the Russians in Ukraine, accept their requests for autonomy of Donetsk and Luhansk? Those things could have prevented the war. And so there's a lot of criticism of President Trump for saying Zelensky shouldn't have started the war, and how can he blame Ukraine for the war? Well, actually, Ukraine was being abused and manipulated by America. America could certainly be blamed for provoking the war. But Ukraine played its part, too, by allowing itself to be used and abused. Having American biological warfare laboratories and American missiles on their soil is a provocation to Russia. Coup d'etats are a provocation to Russia. Wanting to join NATO is a provocation. And you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. We need to understand what's been going on. We've been lied to a lot, and there's been a lot of distortions. And my East European friends think the American government and the British government are extremely hypocritical. Considering the Allies betrayed over 100 million Christians in East European countries to Stalin's Soviet Union through the Yalta Agreement in 1945. Remember, it was Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt sitting with Joseph Stalin at Yalta who betrayed the whole of Eastern Europe. Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, East Germany, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia betrayed them into the hands of the Soviet Union the worst dictatorship on earth. And Ukraine, bear in mind, was also freed by Germany back in 1917. And this independence was even recognized by Vladimir Lenin's Soviet Union in the Brest-Litovsk Treaty of March 1918. But it was the Allies at the Versailles Treaty who betrayed Ukraine back into the hands of the Soviet Union. And many millions of Ukrainians were slaughtered, first under Vladimir Lenin, then under Joseph Stalin's brutal purges. And the kulaks were farmers. And de-kulakization was presented as land reform. And the official state newspaper, Pravda, declared in order to eliminate the kulaks as a class, the resistance of this class must be smashed in open battle. They must be deprived of productive sources of its existence and development. You must take away from them all the land, instruments of production, land renting, right to higher labor, etc. Our goal is the elimination of the kulaks as a class. And under this de-kulakization policy, 18 million peasants in Ukraine lost their homes, their farms. Millions were deported to Siberia, to the Arctic hellhole. Up to 11 million Ukrainians died in the massacres and resultant man-made famine, the starvation between 1929 and 1936, what came to be called the Holodomor, which means the hunger plague. And from 1932 to 1933, millions died. They were starved to death by Stalin's policies. And if you want to see a film dramatizing these horrors of the Soviet Holodomor in Ukraine, you can see the film Bitter Harvest, which Max Irons and Samantha Banks, Samantha Box, and Terence Stamp star in. Ukraine was liberated again by the Germans in 1941, but then betrayed by the Allies through the Yalta Agreement back into the bloodstained hands of Stalin's Soviet Union. And as our friends in Eastern Europe point out, without the extravagant support of the United States and the United Kingdom and Canada, Stalin's Soviet Union couldn't have even survived Operation Barbarossa in 1941. But even before the United States entered the Second World War officially, vast quantities of military hardware were being flown, shipped, trucked into Russia by Alaska, Persia, and Murmansk. In fact, the British invaded Persia in order to enable most of the American aid to reach Russia through the southern underbelly through what is today Iran. The Ukrainian and Lithuanian armies continued to fight for their freedom and independence even 10 years after the conclusion of the Second World War. Units of the Ukrainian army were still operating with field artillery, company strength, fighting valiantly against the Red Army as late as 1955, yet they never received any support from the Allies. And this was documented by American President Herbert Hoover in Freedom Betrayed. He documents the treacherous role played by the United States in fomenting the Second World War, escalating it, bailing out and supporting the worst mass murdering dictatorship in the world, Stalin's Soviet Union, betraying 15 nations and over 100 million Christians of Eastern and Central Europe to the hideous oppression of the communist Russian and NKVD secret police. Under Operation Keelhaul, over 2 million Russians and 1 million Ukrainians in Western Europe were forcibly repatriated by British and American troops into the hands of the Soviet NKVD, who massacred most of them out of hands and the rest they consigned to slave labor in the gulags of Siberia. And I remember reading Nicholas Bethel's book, The Last Secret, and it wasn't The Last Secret, I'm afraid many more came since. Hugh Trevor Roper wrote the introduction. And this is absolutely scandalous. Now, we could have been a role of peace. You just think of people like Theodore Roosevelt, President Teddy Roosevelt. He negotiated peace between Japan and Russia when there was a war between Russia and Japan in 1905. He is a peacemaker. You think of Henri Dunant, the man of the Red Cross, the Swiss citizen who launched the International Red Cross, which is probably the greatest humanitarian relief group in history of the world. And those are the ways we could get involved. We could help practically, either by bringing peace, not funding the war. But no, instead, we whipped up the war rhetoric, lied, 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 and promoted this war with the consequent deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, probably over 1 million already. Now, you'd hope, at a time of tragic crisis and war, that lessons could be learned. Meddling in other countries is never a good idea. Sponsoring revolutions and coups to topple foreign governments can have catastrophic consequences. And this is not only true for Ukraine, but also Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, and Syria, and Egypt. And how many countries have been destabilized by USAID corruption and funding? And violating agreements and ignoring warnings can be disastrous. Abolishing minority language rights for Russians in Ukraine, refusing requests for autonomy in regions with a Russian majority population was not wise. And continuing to expand NATO and the European Union eastwards, despite repeated warnings from Russia, was viewed as threatening Russia's strategic security. And refusing the application by Russia to join NATO was, in hindsight, not the best policy. And isolating and enforcing sanctions and threatening Russia not only drove away this potential ally from the West, but forced them to make a deal with China. Russia could be a powerful Western ally to counter the rising threat of Red China. But alienating and demonizing Russia has not improved the security of NATO. And American meddling in Ukraine did not improve the lives or the security of the Ukrainians at all. In fact, it's been the worst catastrophe to visit them since the Second World War in the Soviet Union. Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And now we're having this exposed to us, what was going on in these areas. And so we should be praying for the Christians in Russia and Ukraine. And I praise God that some sanity is returning to international relations, that at least America and Russia are talking peace. That's very promising. And we can only pray that this comes to an end soon. And 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 1 to 2 says, "Finally, brethren, pray for us, that the word of the Lord may run swiftly and be glorified, just as it is with you, that we may be delivered from unreasonable and wicked men, for not all have faith." And it is true, we need to continually be praying for peace. We need to be mobilizing missionaries into these areas. We need to be lighting a candle, not cursing the darkness. It's so much better to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And if people are interested in learning about our mission, which is a mission to war zones where we've got a track record of trying to win our enemies to Christ, evangelize enemies, even turning terrorists into evangelists, taking the gospel to guerrillas, the Messiah to Muslims, we have had a lot of success in seeing people who are enemies of the gospel won over. And so I think many of these war zones in the world, there's no political solution or military solution, but there could be a spiritual solution. If we would get serious about fulfilling the Great Commission and evangelizing even our enemies in the war zone areas, we could see dramatic transformation in many areas. As I've seen, the war zones I started in Mozambique and Angola, we did a lot of evangelism, won many communists to Christ, and now these countries are free and open, peaceful, no more war, with churches free to open again in areas where they were once scorched earth and conflict areas. I've documented this in the killing fields of Mozambique, Faith Under Fire in Sudan, and Angola by the back door. We've got a track record of winning our enemies, and I hope that more churches would take the challenge that instead of sending in the Marines, how about sending in the missionaries? Instead of bombing them, how about sending in Bibles? Instead of increasing the hate and dialing up the rhetoric, how about thinking about being part of the solution? And I can give a great example on this. Back in 1981, we launched a campaign called the 7-Year Jericho Prayer March, which was joining the Leipzig Prayer Meetings initiative of praying for the fall of the Berlin Wall, praying for the collapse of the Iron Curtain, praying for the opening up of Eastern Europe to the gospel. And I was part of the Bible smuggling operations and the radio broadcasts into Radio Free Europe, Transworld Radio, trying to bring the gospel behind the Iron Curtain, and went into these countries. I ministered in Albania, Bulgaria, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, East Germany. And we saw transformation. And it's a wonderful thing that today you look at the map of Eastern Europe, much of it looks more like the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk that Germany forced on Russia in 1917 than the Versailles Treaty's disastrous map. And you can see how Eastern Europe has now reverted mainly to the vision of Brest-Litovsk, which was self-determination, where the Germans insist that Russia recognize the independence of Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And that was a good initiative. And we can only hope and pray that sound minds are going to prevail in the future. Praise God for the rejection of globalism that is now growing, and that we can work on nation states and trying to bring about peace instead of war. Blessed are the peacemakers. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. I'm just going to mute Peter for a moment while my audio catches up. Just to let you all know, folks, you would have noticed a jump in the recording approximately 30 minutes and 20 seconds ago. What happened was my mixer crashed, so I couldn't hear Peter. I had to restart that and also restart the recorder. We've only lost literally a handful of seconds, so it's just to let you know. Suddenly, oh, it seemed to jump and miss a bit there. That is what happened, but we only literally missed a few seconds, so I hope that didn't ruin your enjoyment of the show. But Peter, can you please let the audience know where they can find your work and how they can contact you?
Thank you, Andrew. I've written on quite a lot of these battles, including Behind Iron Curtain and a lot of the politically incorrect understanding of these wars that have been taking place in my book, Frontline Behind Enemy Line for Christ. You can visit our website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org. Frontline Mission SA. SA short for South Africa, so frontlinemissionsa.org. You'll see audios, videos, country reports, posters, details, books, and if anyone's interested in inviting us to come minister in the area, or you've got volunteers who want to come and join us, be trained, get involved in these sort of positive work in restrictive access areas, my personal email is peter@frontline.org.za or ZA. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. Okay, let's play the closing music. Just to let you know before we do, Peter and I will be back with you in 3 weeks' time. So I want to thank all of you for joining us today on a show entitled The Real Story of the Ukraine War and Why It Must End. I'll be back with you all tomorrow, and until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye for now.